Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Denise Michaud, Chair of the Grownups Forum, and we are going to learn some valuable tips today on what we should say to someone suffering from a loss. Let me introduce our speakers. Dana Lacey and Marissa has studied condolences for over 20 years. She founded Be a Bridge Condolences Project to teach people how to have meaningful conversations during this time. Her most recent book offers real help for us. It's called Condolences Pocket Guide, What to Say and Not to Say to Grievers. Please welcome Dana. Dr. Nate Heinerman is a philosopher and psychotherapist. He teaches at the University of San Francisco in the School of Nursing and Department of Theology and Religious Studies. He serves as the chair of the San Francisco Bay Area Network for End-of-Life Care. Dr. Heinerman also maintains a psychotherapy practice, helping clients as they're going through a loss. Please welcome Dr. Nate Heinerman. Enjoy the program.
Thank you so much for coming out on a Monday night, especially for a topic like this. Also, Dana and I know almost all of you, so it's always nice to be surrounded by warm faces. So much love to you. Thank you for coming. Dana and I have been gifted before to be able to present in a similar fashion a couple of few times. And so based on the strength and the reward value of those successes, we decided to do it again in a slightly different vein. And so, so grateful to you. Obviously, our goal is to make this as meaningful as it possibly can to you and to spoke. It's just some conversation about why condolences can get us into trouble and why they can be tricky, and maybe some approaches that you haven't considered for how we might avoid some of the pitfalls and say what you really want to say. So it's a short, straightforward program, but they're not always easy to do, these condolences. So, for example, I'll just say I grew up in foster care in Eastern Kentucky, and I used to watch this show, Three's Company. I don't know if you remember that with Suzanne Summers and John Ritter. And so that to me was, that was California, you know, Disneyland. And then when you're done, you full up on Disneyland and surfing. Why? That's the time you just retire and you go to Vegas and you pull the slots until it's all done. And I thought, well, that's heaven, because it was so different than Appalachia where I had grown up. Oh, but when I got out here and moved to Berkeley and started my, there was just as much suffering or more out here as there was from the little holler that I came from. So when I was initially doing my doctoral work in philosophy, I was very interested in this topic of suffering. And the long story short is I had a wonderful professor at Cal who called me over to the side during the dissertation defense. And he says, Nate, you know, I'm just concerned. The theoretical meaning of any proposition is always borne out in its behavioral consequences. You know this. I said, well, of course I do. But can you say it again? He said, don't separate theory from practice. He says, you're writing this dissertation on what it's like to live with death awareness or death anxiety. We know we're going to die. We don't know when. He said, you're writing this as if this is some philosophical experiment. He said, this is what happens to everyone. I think you should learn how to serve people who are dying. So I was 24. So I took his advice and I went to the Zen Hospice Project on Laguna and Page, and I went through their hospice training. And that lasted several years. What I took away from that, and what I wanted to get to that story to tell you this, because it links with what Dana's going to say next. So ever since that moment in hospice, I changed. I went back, did another master's and doctorate in psych, changed my research interests in many, many ways. And like, as Denise was saying, now I see patients and treat, you know, mostly folks, working with folks mostly at the end of life, although I do treat a lot of depression. It was in the recognition during that hospice training of the profundity of how mindfulness, especially the version that I was shown, can cut across both lack of clarity and consternation, the kind of consternation that gives rise to suffering. And the metaphor for this teaching of mindfulness, you've heard maybe a million times, but this day during my training in 1993 was the first time I'd ever heard it. You are the sky, Your thoughts, feelings, sensations, all the other stuff, those are clouds. You can get lost in those. You'll be, if you do, confused, perhaps. So to remember, I am the sky, not the cloud, is the first, most basic, if we're using metaphors, approach or step into mindfulness, to unhook from the thought or the fear or the feeling or the sensation that otherwise might be harshing our mellow or just causing us anxiety. So sitting in hospice with big feelings, learning how to manage big feelings, came a discussion one day on the difficulty in condolences. And I'm going to pass it right now. But I just want to say, within like 2 or 3 minutes, this one afternoon, myself and just half a dozen other volunteers at the Zen Hospice Project, we ask ourselves, what is it? What really is a condolence? We were after what makes a good condolence. But a lot of us were kind of philosophical. So we said a condolence really at heart is just an expression. It can tie to grief, but it doesn't even have to tie to that. It's an expression of sympathy, or maybe a meta communication. Maybe it's just a knowing look. But that way of acknowledging, if you'd like, someone else's loss, so that we could help alleviate some of their suffering, so that we could help build up perhaps some of their coping potency, so that we might help them explain some of these difficult emotions with our condolence, or provide validation, or proffer up perhaps some opportunity for them to see this pain in a more supported view. Or if nothing else, we offer condolences often because we want to. We are aware of having had some feeling, sensation, or series of thoughts as a result of the loss or the transition, and we want to say something. So all of these motivators are fine enough. But why is it then, though, that so many of those good intentions land on the other side of the ledger in the missed connection category? And just as quickly as we came up with those, we came up with four really good reasons why a lot of times condolences don't work. We are mismatched emotionally. The person we're trying to give the condolence to, they're in one mood, I'm in another. Or maybe I just communicate poorly. In a world where everything is on text, there's a lot of room for not getting it or getting what the author intended. So sometimes we just don't communicate it right. Still yet, sometimes I think there's a kind of, let's put it this way, there's a grief burden some carry, whether it's at a funeral or if I see someone out in the street who's I know has had a loss, I can feel, some people report, I feel the weight of both the responsibility that I have that I must say something and at the same time a sense, I don't want to say anything. I don't know what to say. And so it's from that place of conflict sometimes then that an effort is made towards a condolence. So there's all these ways in which it can, that our condolence may not land in the way in which we want it. And when you were preparing for this book and you were teaching me in part about those and many other denominations of not helpful condolences. You really helped me see that this is a bigger issue. And so tell us more about these problematic condolences and how you've been able to study them and work with them.
Great. Well, thank you, Nate. That was so inspiring. So I got into offering or learning about condolences through a lunch date. I had been invited to have lunch at a girlfriend's house, and she had invited her best friend, a guy named Mark. I'd met him once, and when we did our hellos, how are yous, he said, well, I'm okay, I have lung cancer. And I was like, deer in the headlights, what am I going to say? And as I was posing that question, I heard myself say, can anyone guess the worst thing you can say? Oh, are you a smoker? Yeah. And then I saw this stricken look on his face, so I knew I'd actually said that out loud. And I was mortified. Why would I say something like that? But I didn't have time for that at that moment. What I realized I wanted to do was to make it right. And so I said, you know what? It doesn't matter. I know a lot of people who smoke and they don't have lung cancer. And if you were to be so kind as to let me start again, I would say, I'm just sorry that you have lung cancer. And then I zipped it closed because I knew I wanted to grovel and say, oh, I'm so sorry. And then that would have put an extra burden on him to make me feel better. So I zipped it and I waited. And you won't believe what he said. He said, thank you. Thank you so very much. I had just like gobsmacked this guy verbally and he thanked me. So I decided in that moment that I was going to learn, one, why did I say such a terrible thing? I'm a nice person. Why would I do that? I don't have any problem with this man. And why would he be so ready to forgive me? And so I was excited about this. And then my husband and I lost our daughter. And that draws a line in the sand with your life. Life before the loss and life after the loss. And what was almost as devastating as that loss was what our dear and caring friends and family, acquaintances, what they said to us. It was predominantly unhelpful things. Mm-hmm. Oh, you can have another baby. Well, at least she was only 13 days old, so you didn't get too close. So, and these people loved us, and we loved them. But there was such a gap between what we needed and what they knew to say. And it happened so repetitively, not just sometimes, almost all of the time, and not just from some people, almost all of the people. And it didn't matter whether they were close friends, acquaintances, work people, whether they were educated, not educated. It came from everywhere. And so my husband and I, we were already hurting from the loss of our daughter, and so we were getting these other hurtful comments, and we retreated. And so many of these condolences carry this very subtle subtext that says, don't be sad, don't cry. And I was really sad, and I was crying everywhere. The bank, the grocery store, and not this beautiful little thing you see in the movies with a tear coming down here. Big, loud cries. And so I already felt like I was different than everyone. Mm-hmm. And then when I was being told that I shouldn't be doing that in not very subtle ways, I felt kind of like a freak. And I felt as if all my protections had been torn off and my friends still had their protections. And I saw that they did, and I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't call anyone back. I couldn't be 50% of a friendship. I couldn't, I just couldn't do anything except get up, eat, and go to work, and try to figure out how I was going to make it. So I was talking to a girlfriend about this, and she said, we were talking about the latest condolences, and I said to her, you know, I just wish I had some little pamphlet or something, some little booklet that would explain what my husband and I need when we can't really be the ones educating someone right now. And it would be small, and I could have 20 of them in a basket by the door, and people could, I'd say, why don't you take one of those on your way out? And it would do the work for me. And I was mid-sentence, and I realized, wait a minute, I'm a writer. I've worked as a writer my entire life. I'm going to write this book. And that really helped me have a focus. When I would hear something that was not helpful, I could say, all right, I'm going to figure out why they're saying these things and why there's this huge gap. And I realized that was going to help me charge through this. Mm-hmm. And then my dad died. And I thought, well, maybe it'll be different because, you know, it's my dad. It's not a child. People are more used to dads dying. It was mostly the same. And again, I was so confused about this gap because these were great people. He was a great person. And look what I said to Mark, for goodness sakes. My dad, some of those condolences were, your dad wouldn't want you to be sad. And the payload in that is, so you shouldn't be sad. And in the process of hearing so many of these condolences, I developed four categories of condolences that they can put the slide up where you can see them. And that one was advice or suggestion. Another condolence was it expected or was it sudden? And the payload in that is, I'm trying to find a reason why you shouldn't be as sad as you are. Mm-hmm. And again, with the don't be so sad. So this actually fueled my interest even more. And then we lost our son. And I was like, how does this even happen to one person? Well, two people, me and my husband. How does this happen? And it was the same thing with the condolences, with my husband and I feeling misunderstood and unseen, feeling too vulnerable to actually say anything back. And so finally, that took several years to get past three losses in under 2 years. That was a lot. And I promise there's no more bad news. So when I finally started coming up for air, I decided I was going to investigate this in a serious way. And so I started by looking at all 618 books that were on Amazon about grief and loss. And I talked to anyone who would talk to me about either giving condolences or receiving condolences. And I read every article, journal article, anything I could find that would answer the question of the gap. And so in my interviews, I found some common themes. I started with grievers because I wanted to know, was it me? Mm-hmm. Was I just like too sensitive? Because that was the message that was being delivered a lot. Or was it happening to other people? And so many people said that it was happening to them as well. So then I interviewed friends and family, and what I found were three common threads. One, people were really concerned about right or wrong words. Mm-hmm. Why? Well, I can't know how to say this because I haven't gotten any special training, and you have to study this to know how to do it. When we talked further, there was another commonality from people. And that was, there's anxiety and tension around death, which, you know, makes total sense. People are nervous about talking about death, being around people who are talking about death. But that wasn't the bottom line. Underneath all of that was their fear of grief itself. People were afraid that they too could have that much suffering. And that was my aha moment. And I realized that it's not the fear of death, because we're all afraid. It's what we do with it. And when we shove down, we deny or suppress our fears, the next thing that comes out of our mouth is going to be a little shove away. And most of these pat condolences have a shove. Look at the one that I said to Mark. Are you a smoker? What's the payload in that? Because if you are, you deserve what you got, and I'm not going to be sympathetic. I mean, that's about as big a shove as you can give someone. And it's all done in nice, tidy, pat condolences. And this is no one's fault. We have never been trained. You know, you have your PhD. I had my life's PhD of thousands of unhelpful condolences. But pat condolences are only delivered when we have not acknowledged our fears and our concerns. Mm-hmm. These pat condolences are a small fight or flight response. Because when I look deeply at the circumstance with Mark, when he said he had lung cancer, I was like, oh my God, I just wanted to have lunch. I don't want to go into some really heavy thing. But I didn't even know that I had, that was what was happening. I shoved that bad boy down so fast because I didn't want to be that person. But there it came out of my mouth. And it's that disconnect between who we really are and what we can accept about ourselves. And if we cannot accept, you know, warts and all, then we will not be able to accept the noisy cry that I was doing, the inappropriate places that I was crying. So we have asked people to, has anyone ever felt this way? Like when I was talking to Mark, anyone in the audience ever wondered, wow, I wonder if that was really helpful, what I just said?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or anyone thought, oh, I'm real sure that wasn't helpful, what I just said. Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about, Nate's going to talk about some of the unhelpful condolences that you have written down. Thank you for doing that.
So these are wonderful. And so this is just, we're going to splash around. So from the audience to contribute logs on the fire of potential worst condolences ever, but everybody dies. Seriously, could it be for the best? Question mark. Please come again. Any reference to your own loss? So it goes something like, sorry to hear about your dad. Now that reminds me of when my grandpa died now 2 years ago. Now see, he was a real interesting guy and the blah, 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 blah. So we've co-opted the story. So this one, so sorry for your loss. So sorry for your loss. So, you know, the way that we can deliver these with intent isn't always the way in which they're received. Hmm. And so, yeah. So maybe the person who receives so sorry for their loss, I could imagine someone could be both heartened and perhaps not so much with
right.
that, depending on what. And then last, there's a bunch, but we'll just stop here. Well, at least you have XYZ, you see, because gratitude and toxic positivity can negate what the person is experiencing. So this is the unhelpful one. Well, at least you have X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
Don't hang your head. the sun will come out tomorrow. And you know, and as we've talked too, and you know, some of us who are coming in, you know, we just lost one of the greatest writers on this theme, Philip Roth, one of the greatest fiction writers ever, but an American fiction writer at that. And his what he's known for, the theme, damage in the name of goodness. All of his characters are aspiring to get it right, to try and surprise somebody by joy, to take the more responsible route, the more accountable route, the more difficult path, to try and have it pay off. But in Roth's novels, they don't pay off. Oftentimes, when we try and give our best, it gets misinterpreted and then rerouted and then shoved back. Shove back on us. And so I'm thinking of American Pastoral here. But the point is, in each of these cases, there's a real, you can almost see the goodness of the person sending it, but that there wasn't alignment with the person who was receiving it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So keep going. These were some. Yeah.
Yes. So you've heard some that were delivered to me, but how, so now we've identified the problem. How do we bridge this gap between what we know to say and what grievers need? So there's a tiny shift that we can do that moves us out of the fight or flight mode and into a kinder, more accepting version of ourselves, where we have actually some compassion for ourselves. And so when I was studying condolences and interviewing people, I developed this three-step thing. And this actually comes quite naturally to me because my entire career has been either teaching college Spanish or skiing or working as a marketing writer in the telecom industry, where I had to explain technical ideas to non-technical audiences. I even started my career as a tech writer, where I wrote instructions for how to use software programs. So this combination of me really early on deciding that I wanted to know what's behind people's motivations. Even as a young girl, I wanted to know, why did my mom act like that? Why did my sister act like that? Why did I act like that? And when I got old enough to know that there was such thing as counseling, I jumped right in, because that was where my mind went anyway, pardon the pun. And so I gathered all this information, and my mind naturally went to, well, how am I going to explain this to anybody? So I developed these three steps to caring condolences. And I call these condolences be a bridge condolences, because as I mentioned, when I was grieving, I was completely unable to bridge any gap. I couldn't call my friends. I couldn't respond. I couldn't answer people's questions. People had to come to me. And I couldn't do the social niceties of cutting people slack for saying a hard condolence. We, you know, we hear things that we don't like all the time in life, and it just rolls off. Not when you're grieving. You just don't have any extra room for that. And so I am wondering who here would like to do the three steps to caring condolences together? Anyone? Just one. Okay, Nate and I are going to do it.
I've heard about this. So.
Okay. All right. So if you would like to participate, get comfortable in your seat. And before we start, think of a person in your life, either right now or in the past, where you're not quite sure that what you said or what you know to say would be that helpful, and you'd really like some help with that. So get this person and their situation firmly in mind, and then if you feel comfortable, close your eyes or soften your gaze and take a deep breath. And breathe down into your body. This is where we're going to ground ourselves, and each person likely has their own grounding mechanism. Some people put a hand on the heart. Some people imagine their breath going down into their hips and their legs, down into the earth. Some people connect with their higher power and gain confidence and steadiness there. And so now that you've done that, step one is to move your focus off of the griever and onto yourself. How do you feel about this situation with the griever? Let's not worry about how they feel. How do you feel? Are you nervous? Are you irritated by all their crying? Maybe you're impatient, their grief has gone on so long, because it goes on for a while. Are you angry that they've changed, afraid of doing the wrong thing? Have some curiosity and kindness toward yourself and take a look at how you actually feel. Don't try and change it, because whatever it is fine. And it's in accepting and being a kind, curious elder to yourself and your feelings that we actually can accept the griever and whatever they're going through. This is also how we drop our guard. We're not so protected. And it really is only in noticing what we feel that we actually start to change it, not on purpose, but we get a tiny shift out of a defended, I shouldn't feel this way, I don't like the way this is going, into an open and accepting, this is really who I am right in this moment. And step three is turn your attention back to the griever. And now that you've made this shift, what occurs to you to say to them or do for them? Do you notice anything new that shows up for you, having made this slight shift? And when you feel comfortable, come back into the room, open your eyes, shake it off. And is there anyone here who noticed that they now had a different idea about what to say or do? You apologize for the faux pas and it just felt off your shoulders. That's great. That just because you have healed some does not mean you will never suffer that pain again, like a broken bone. Thank you for that. How about someone else? Yes.
Thank you. An awful lot of things that people experience when they lose a partner, let's say, or a child, there just becomes a lot of priorities in life that kind of go by the wayside. So anyhow, I think that what I would do is offer some way, whether it's bringing a meal or taking care of a chore or walking a dog. I think those things would be helpful.
That is lovely. And I would add one little caveat. Because I was overwhelmed, I couldn't make decisions about anything. Like I'd get up and have to make breakfast. My eyes would glaze over. I couldn't even figure out what to do. I found it helpful when people said, I would like to make you some food. I can do either this or this or this. Would any of those be helpful? And then they can go that one. And so you don't ask them to help you figure out what to do for them. You come, I would like to mow your lawn tomorrow. Will that be okay? Will you be home tomorrow so I can drop off some food? Make a suggestion so they can just say yes, because that's all I had. Thank you so much for that. How about anyone else?
I noticed I had a little bit more patience when we had that thought, and so I'm hoping that I'll be able to continue with that patience for that particular person I was thinking of,
right,
who has been has had a broken bone for a long time. And so that person has changed, and it is hard. And sometimes I don't know what to say, or I just like, I don't want to go down that path and with that particular person.
Right. And that's a very good point, too, because we are not boundless fonts of energy to give to someone else. We have limitations. Mm-hmm. And if we can't be there for someone, we need to say that in a way where we own it completely. I wish I could be there for you now, but what I can do is make some food for you. Or thank you so much for sharing everything that you've just shared with me. I'm going to have to go home and really ponder this in my heart. Thank you so much. You're fine. You're great. What do you think about that?
It reminds me, there's a class called Death and Dying. This is the 25th year that I've taught it at USF. And one of the assignments that we do in that class is have students in 2024 handwriting condolences. So this is pushing a lot of, boundaries and pushing back, technology in some ways. But with the condolences, this is one of the most fun things that we do, because we all analyze both the condolences that were received well and those that weren't to those that they sent. And as has been said, and I'll just echo it here, the largest challenge my students have, 18 to 25-year-old, mostly undergrad, although mostly going into helping professions, is that they want to. They feel it's important to, but they don't know what to say. And that emotional weight begins to do some work in sort of kicking doubt, raising up some, you don't really need to do this. And so people get, so they talk themselves out of it, of trying to find the words to say, and ultimately deciding not to do it sometimes, even though there's an assignment, because they don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. So in discussing that assignment over the years, one thing comes pretty clear. When we give a condolence, we know that it's not inherent in the words that we choose, that it's going to work magically and take away all this person's pain. Now, no words are going to fix whatever this condolence is coming. So what the condolence is, what am I doing? What is this expression even about then? I think is a fair play. What is this gift or acknowledgement, this thing I could say or reflect back to my beloved or my patient? What is it that I'm wanting to say that I feel like should be said? That I want to say, that I think could be helpful and skillful here, and not necessarily so much about me. That, in my experience at least, just in my own personal experience, I need that mindfulness first step. Because when I see the person who I know is recently bereft, I often am right there in an emotional story, and I am the story. I am my feeling. Oh, gotta go see. And I'm up and going. And now I bring my counseling stuff over, and I'm talking, and it's off and going. And in the context of being lost in thought, even if it's good thought or caring thought, we can, without being mindful, say some things that maybe aren't going to be absorbed as very, very helpful, or wouldn't be seen as abundantly helpful by the person we're talking to. So this check-in, three-stage of a mindfulness, what's at stake? Let me get a deep breath. Given the context of this moment, where we're at, how much time I've got with her or him, I think I'll say this, or I'll go this route. And needless to say, but when we play the tape back and encourage the students to use this more triadic structure with mindfulness driving the ship, the students don't, what's interesting is they don't report as much about the clarity of success with the original condolence, but they themselves become so much more aware of their own grieving process and what this loss means to them. Well, it's tough, and I'll shut up on this, but it's tough to send a good condolence without getting some grip on what it's bringing up for you. So sometimes to do condolences, we got to do a little grief work first. And I think that's what you and your book says so well. You know, a lot of times we'd like to just give the grief help and stay far, far away. But that's how we set it up and build goodness to spill and to cause damage in this way. Because there's all sorts of ways in which these comments can be perceived. And
I really like what you were saying, Nate, about how you lose your focus shifts from being really concerned about, well, how did it land, to having this interior experience. And that is the choice that we make. Am I going to make my feelings more important than theirs? Am I going to make protecting my own feelings of hurt or grief more important than opening up and doing something for them? And it is a choice, because there are some moments when I cannot do that. And I'm best left to say, oh, I've been thinking so much about you, let me call you, I've got to run. And not like gritting my teeth, because when people did that with me, I could tell. And then I felt like, oh my God, I'm just such a loser. Because, and I'm part of this culture, and there's a lot of harshness toward, or lack of acceptance toward non-able-bodied people. And when you are sobbing uncontrollably in public, you fall squarely into that category. And so it is a different space to occupy. So that decision is a good one to know when you can offer something and when you can't.
So it's okay not to give the condolence.
Yes. If you can't, I mean, it was very painful to me when people would be walking toward me and they'd cross the street and walk on the other side of the street. That told me they couldn't do it. It was painful. I think there's a nicer way to do that. You can come up to someone and say, listen, you've been on my mind. Now's not a good time, but I will reach out to you. And that would mean a lot to me. Mm-hmm. And condolence notes. I'm so glad you're doing that with your students, because I can still count on one hand the condolence notes that I received. And it's like 23 years, wow. And I remember every single one of them. And that's the other thing. People think, well, I got to do this good thing for someone else. We are in a place where, I don't know about you, but I'm looking to make connections with people. You know, we had the pandemic and we've gotten isolated, and I'm living in a new city. I'm just learning after the pandemic to come out of my shell and meet people. It's making connections is meaningful. And there was a woman in my small town of Oregon that I lived in for almost a decade who had a tragic loss. Her daughter died in a car accident where she was driving under the influence. It doesn't get much worse than that. And I knew that she was living in some kind of hell. And so I would write her text messages, hey, I'm thinking about you. And I would tell her a little bit about my life. Just know that I love you. No need to respond if you don't want to. And every single one I ended, no need to respond. Because when people would send me a text and I couldn't respond, I just felt, what is wrong with me? Mm-hmm. And I felt this burden, like this to-do list was stacking up of things, like someone mentioned, that just don't get done when you're grieving. And just about the time that I was like, gosh, maybe these condolences aren't really helpful. Is this really doing anything? I sent her one more, and she wrote me back, and she goes, I can't even tell you how much your messages mean to me. I felt like the king of the world. I felt so happy. And so I am happy that it was meaningful to her, but look what it did for me. And that is something else we can remember, that when we are concerned about a condolence, if we make the effort and we have even the minutest bit of success, we are going to feel like $1 million because we have made a connection that matters. These are places in our lives that matter a lot. And if we can rise to that occasion in whatever fumbling way we can figure out, you're going to feel like $1 million, or at least I did.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I can't really see. Sorry.
Thank you. First, it would be nice if the club would put your names up on these screens, because I don't think we can tell who you really are in terms of your names.
Okay.
And I think that's a serious omission the club should reconsider. Secondly, we've talked about words tonight.
Yeah.
But in fact, body language can also be very important as well. In the words we don't say, what's left unsaid can be more powerful than what's said, either appropriately, inappropriately, well-received or ill-received. And I'll give you a quick example in the corporate world. When this comes from the hotel business, the senior managers will maybe fire somebody, and maybe not for good reason either, or a person has had some really unfortunate circumstances beyond their control, and they'll just grin and smile, and it actually makes things worse.
Thank you
for that. Yes.
If I can just quickly respond to this. So yeah, I agree with everything that you said, and I'm curious to hear what you think. So in my experience, at least, the more acute the particular setting or moment, the fewer words that are available in general to fix, because the nonverbal meta communication is the broad enough tool, language tool, the tier that's the lingua franca. I'm not philosophizing now, because there's no good but I love what you said, because this is exactly it. So when you do the three steps, like you're going to do this condolence, and you drop in on that first step, and you're thinking about the person that you're going to do this condolence for, well, you know, one thing that I like to do to sort of goose my own participation and try and get it to a sort of a maximum level of skill is to really be mindful of the tone of my own voice talking to me and talking to this person. What's the nature of my internal voice? Is it rushed? Is it demanding? We got to do this. You should have had this done. Is it kind? Is it patient? Is it for her? Or is it for me? So my attitude, which I actually think that may be what I have the most control over in this whole thing before it's said and done, my attitude, that's also what I want to track as a guide to help me make sure that in those steps, this gift, hopefully it's a gift that I'm giving in this condolence, is going to land right. One last thing. We talked about this the very first time this came up. You know, I mean, because you and I work in grief and loss, and Don and so many others, you know, to have difficult conversations is not an uncommon, you know, part of our job. Condolences, though, are a special type of communication. They're designed to do things, like to achieve solidarity or to connect people's empathy and sympathy. It's an expression, but it has a purpose too, and it can be multi-layered in its purpose. But here's the point. For most, that person that we're trying to give the condolence to, that's such a precious and difficult pain that we're trying to give language to, or some nod, or some communication to touch that very tender place in that person. And with this condolence, whether it's viva voce or otherwise, that's a pretty ambitious thing to set out to do. And so we ought be prepared if we're going to try to get really into the center of what is most important in someone's emotional life by your words. We probably want to get that right. We want to be really sensitive. We want to be really skillful. And, you know, if we don't get it right, that's okay. We want to own that too and say, gosh, you know, what I was trying to say was. So these are just little things. I think, Dana said it perfectly, but I, even in my own process, I like to just pay special attention to my own, the attitude of my own voice as a barometer for the relative worthiness of this condolence I'm about to give out. If my attitude internally is lousy, I'm not going to give the condolence, even if the words seem right. Because there's something off in the tone, and I probably need another minute or two to kind of drop down into it and see what really is coming up for me.
I love that. I had a question from a hospice nurse at Mission Hospice. I was giving a 3-part training to their nursing staff. And he said, you know, I see a lot of patients all day long, and I'm running out of ways to say I'm sorry for your loss. Can you give me some words? And I said, no, actually, I'm sorry for your loss can be 20 different messages depending on how you say it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so a policeman saying sorry for your loss.
Yeah.
Or someone who's in a hurry. Oh, sorry. But if you do the work that Nate has been talking about just now, you can touch something in yourself that's like, I really am so sorry for your loss. And that is the piece that I discovered that Mark responded to. He was willing to forgive the most egregious message I could give him because I shifted immediately to, I screwed up and I am not going to be that person. And I made a change. And I essentially became vulnerable and said, I hope you'll forgive me. I really do care about you. And he was so ready to forgive me. And when I was grieving, I would cut anyone any kind of slack if they could tell me truthfully about them. I could never know. Most of the pat condolences I call smoke screens because they all are talking about you, the griever. Oh, don't you think it's time for you to start getting out? Oh, you really need to move on. It's about you, you, you. And it doesn't reveal anything about me. In social situations, we're taught it's polite to ask a question. How are you? How was your day? What happened? That doesn't work with a griever because it's a smokescreen. I say, if I want something from the griever, I have to give it to them first. What can I give them? I can give them my humanity. I can stand by them when they are mourning out loud in a public place and not flinch. When people could do that for me, oh my God, I just felt like okay, I can make it another day. It was such a blessing. All right, there's one person here that I know does not think I'm blowing it in my grief. And it was a miracle. Mm. And I would forgive anything if I could have those moments with people, because they are magic. And it's the magic that you have been talking about as well. It's really an integrative process. There's no one slam dunk. Yes, I've divided it into three steps, but we can't stand there on the sidewalk. We run into someone and say, hold on, I got to do my three steps. You practice it in less rigorous contexts, and you get some facility with taking a breath. Oh, yeah, I am anxious about this. Okay, I got this. And then you develop a facility with knowing where you're at and being able to offer your truth to someone else.
Yes. Just to take some time to drop in, mm-hmm, before we just react and blurt, yes, something out that could have the opposite intent. And we see it all the time. And usually, unlike other speech acts out there in the world, if we bungle a condolence, you and I have laughed before, those tend to stick. People remember those. They remember the slight, or they remember the tone that wasn't right, or the card that wasn't sent, or all this, mm-hmm, stuff. And so to be able to take the time and really deliver the attention to given its importance, these condolences, it's important to put time into it. Do we want to do Q&A with the last 5 minutes? We've got a couple questions.
If you have
time for one.
Oh, you have some questions?
Well, so Denise, I can check my phone. If there isn't any, I do have one.
Dana, Nate, we have a question here.
Okay.
Did you do some anthropology research, and what were some of the common threads, if you had, about cultures and people's condolences and caring for the process of grieving?
I did not. I really didn't. I found it very challenging to investigate this culture. So, but I think it would be, I do know that in other cultures, when someone is grieving, there is a crying room or a crying place where you show your support by crying. If someone bursts into tears, you burst into tears too, and you cry out loud with them. But yeah, every culture has, well, and I've lived in Mexico the last 13 years, and I've noticed some differences, but a lot of similarities there as well. So that's, it's very informal. How about you?
Oh, it's a deep, deep question. And I mean, when you get into the studying of these deep cross-cultural comparisons, especially just around even end-of-life practices, it's just fascinating. You can get places in history and geography that rhyme and they're right next to each other. And then you can get something crazy like, you know, the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the transmigration of the soul leaving the body. And that almost is exactly like what the Native American Cherokee tribe had, the transmigration of the soul. And if you compare these texts, well, I mean, how were they, you know, communicating 10,000, I don't know. But what you find are these, and you obviously have, these wonderfully synchronous kinds of discoveries that almost always seem to sort of push towards Houston Smith direction of a kind of ecumenism often, or a kind of shared set of practices. Sometimes the practices have different interpretations, but the practice, let's say burning possessions with the body, it's pretty consistent practice. So these are all done in the spirit, like we're trying to talk about with condolences, which is to help a community heal, to help alleviate pent-up suffering in and around this unexpected loss and the tear that it's made in the societal structure. So,
yes, I play a game kind of language. So when the wife announced something like, her husband had passed away. So they would say, my husband is plain dead, something like that.
Oh, wow.
They're plain dead. They passed away. That is part of his plain, something like that.
That is so interesting. Thank you for that. Yes.
We have one question over here.
I think it's important to check in with the person who's experienced a tragedy quite a few months later. I think it's important to go back to the broken bone kind of thing.
Thank you for that. That's one of the things I cover in here, that it's not one condolence and then you're done. It's these people are going to be grieving for a years, and I'm developing a set of condolence cards, and one of them, and part of this box set, is a calendar where you can mark the date of the person's passing and send something once a month for 3 months, and then on the birthday and on Christmas, and that is how we can acknowledge someone's loss.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have come to the close of our meeting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dana.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for all your wisdom here today. And this concludes our meeting celebrating 121 years of enlightened discussion.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.